Seats Podcast for Tuesday, February 17th. I'm your host, John Lord. My guest today, Gary Glassman of Providence Pictures, is a television producer, director, and writer whose latest documentary, Colosseum Roman Death Trap, is the first of three Building Wonders specials developed for Nova and PBS. Gary, welcome to the View My Seats Podcast, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you, John.
So the Roman Colosseum has been the focus of countless television specials. What would you say makes your documentary different from all the rest?
Well, one of the things that we do is we look at the building as a snapshot in stone. The idea being that it's the physical embodiment of the culture at that moment in time. And then what we do in terms of making the film is we're confronted with the challenge of, you know, how do you bring that alive for a modern audience? How do you make it real? How do you actually convey that the people who built the Colosseum and who engaged in those bloody spectacles inside the arena were no different from ourselves? And so what I've developed as part of this Building Wonders series is this concept of actually building something, building some aspect of the monument that might crystallize the meaning of the building. And in this case, for the Colosseum, what we looked at was ancient Roman texts that claimed that animals, wild beasts from all over the extent of the empire, of the Roman Empire, from Eastern Asia to parts of Africa and all throughout Europe, that animals were brought there and magically appeared into the arena. They just sort of appeared from the floors beneath. And so we were looking at, did they do that? Did they actually do that? Are these texts true? And if they did, how did they do it? So what we did was we worked with an architect who had been studying this problem for years and developed this idea that there was a massive lift and trap door system beneath the floor of the arena. And we worked with him to design, build, and install a full-scale lift and trap door system in the Colosseum and raise a wolf into the arena for the first time in 1,500 years. So yeah. I would say that I don't know anybody else who's except perhaps an emperor who has taken on that task.
I was going to say you and Emperor Titus are perhaps the only two. It was certainly a surprise, and I do not want to give too much away for those people who have yet to see this Building Wonder special. But in the documentary, you talk about some of the challenges that come up as you are building this lift. Could you just share with us some of the obstacles that you faced in recreating this lift?
Well, the first is, you know, getting permission to, you know, install this into a World Heritage Site.
Right.
You know, and, you know, fortunately, I was able to be put in front of, you know, people who could actually say yes to it. Rosel Araya, who is the director of the Colosseum and one of the foremost experts on the building. And previous to that, I had contacted Heinz Besta, who is the person who really came up with the concept of the lift and trap door system from his work. You know, when I asked him if he would be interested in working with me on this project, if I could actually, you know, build a full-scale model of his design, well, he was very excited about it. So, you know, obviously the first part was getting permission. And, again, fortunately, all of these people that I dealt with, Heinz Besta, Rosel Araya, the people who actually built it, Umberto Baraffaldi, are just as curious as me, and we made it happen.
You know, at one point I got kind of nervous. I was watching that scene where you had to lift the contraption over the Colosseum and down into the hypogeum, the basement, the area below the floor, and the crane came perilously close to tipping, and you had to make the lift lighter. I can only imagine how nerve-wracking that experience must have been, thinking that potentially you were jeopardizing kind of the sanctity, the structure of the Colosseum.
That's right. Because it is a World Heritage Site, we are not allowed to actually alter the fragile walls of the Hypogeum. So what we had to do was, and this was Umberto's genius, was actually build a, it's basically, you know, a 95% scale, almost 100, you know, almost one-to-one scale lift and trap door, but it had to be self-contained, so it had to be, it fit into a massive steel structure, and then besides that, then the wood was all, you know, authentic in terms of how it was done, but there was very, very little leeway for getting it into those walls, between those walls. And yes, it did come perilously close to tipping. Well, I was watching with my daughter, she said, well, you know, Dad, what if it actually fell? And I said, well, probably a lot more people would be watching this program. And I might be watching from an Italian prison.
I was going to say you might still be in Rome.
Yes.
Why do you think, you know, you talk about people watching this documentary on the Colosseum. You know, why do you think the public, your audience, remains so fascinated by the Colosseum?
Well, I think for one thing we can imagine what goes on, what went on in there. Not only from, you know, the original text, the descriptions of what was actually going on, historical documents that describe the activities in there. And of course it's been you know, material for incredible movies such as, you know, Gladiator, a wonderful, incredible movie. So we've seen those films and those stories about it. And then when you look at it, you know, you can, when you actually visit the Colosseum, when you see it, you can imagine those things going on in there. So that's one aspect of it. I think it's easy to visualize and imagine the bloody spectacles that went on in there. But I think the other part of it is really how can a society that was so successful, a civilization that was so successful for hundreds of years, I mean, it was something like, you know, minimum of 500 years dominating the world, how could they justify these spectacles of death and execution? And I think that's one of the reasons why we're so fascinated with it. So I think, you know, just that is alone. I mean, you know, look, I remember going to see Gladiator when it first came out, and in the film when Russell Crowe is still in sort of the minor leagues out in the way outside of Rome. He hasn't come into the Colosseum yet, and he's sort of learning the ropes of being a gladiator. He, you know, he just kills very quickly. And, you know, he's taught that he needs to kill more slowly, that he needs to let the death linger and the violence, you know, be prolonged. And, you know, after slaughtering everybody in the ring, and he throws his sword up into the stands and he says, "Are you not entertained?"
Right.
Yeah, well, we are still entertained by that for some crazy reason.
And it is so much the spectacle of the moment, and it makes you really think whether or not the whole entire event was for the fans. And I'm speaking with filmmaker Gary Glassman. In in Colosseum and Roman Death Trap, one of your experts, Catherine Welch from NYU, says that, and I believe I'm paraphrasing, says that the Colosseum was the embodiment of the Roman world order. And she goes on to say that this Roman world order was infused with a military ethos that was so vital in creating and maintaining an empire. Can you explain how the Colosseum represented this militaristic nature of Roman society?
Well, they theatricalized death. They theatricalized execution. And they enforced their world order right there for the public to see. I mean, again, remember, this is before television or film, and what they would do is they would bring the empire to the capital in Rome, and some festivals would last 100 days, and they would be free, and 50 to 80,000 people packed into that stadium to see these executions. And the idea, I think, is that the Romans made no bones about it. I mean, they displayed the bloodshed proudly. They were letting the people know that the Roman Empire's militaristic power and conquering of other people was directly responsible for the prosperity of the Roman citizens. And the emperor, you know, really kept a balance between sharing that, the spoils of war, the booty of war, with the plebs Romano, the citizens of Rome. And as long as they found some connection to that conquest of the Roman military, then they seemed to be happy with the way the emperor and Rome was being run.
And many of the events that were put together in the Colosseum were actual recreations of past battles that the Romans had fought. And your documentary talks a lot about how the Roman emperor at the time, Vespasian, financed the construction of the very Colosseum with the sacking of Judea and the stealing of a very valuable religious artifacts from the temple in Jerusalem. So clearly Roman conquest has its imprint all over the Colosseum.
Yes, exactly. They displayed it very prominently. There is a stone that we decipher. Rosella Rea actually deciphers it in the film, where they found the original text for the dedication stone of building the Colosseum. And basically it says the Emperor Vespasian built this for the people with the spoils of war from Judea. And then just a few hundred yards from the Colosseum is the Arch of Titus, where Titus being Vespasian's son and the one who actually opens the Colosseum in the year 80, it depicts the sacking of Judea and the temple in Jerusalem and carrying off the spoils of war, along with something like 90,000 slaves.
Who were, I believe, instrumental in the actual construction of the Colosseum.
That's correct. And probably those who survived the construction were probably executed theatrically within that first 100-day ceremony.
And the other interesting connection that I found there in the Colosseum is that Rome derived so much of its culture from ancient Greece. And ancient Greece left an imprint on the Colosseum, but as your documentary states, the people who built the Colosseum were very clear to point out that ancient Greece isn't around anymore. Therefore, Rome is the superior culture, and we may get a lot of our culture from Greece, but we're here, they're not, therefore we're better than ancient Greece.
That's right. And again, interestingly, with the Romans get a lot of their sort of architectural style, certainly their the pantheon of their gods, most of them comes from Greece. But interestingly, the amphitheater itself is a uniquely Roman structure. We often call people who've been to Greece, you know, we'll look at these beautiful theaters that are built into hillsides, and those are in fact Greek theaters. We often call them amphitheaters, but they're not amphitheaters; they're theaters. What the Romans did is they took the Greek theater and they doubled it. Amphitheater actually means double theater. But instead of just doubling it, which would have made a circle, they elongated into an elliptical shape. And this becomes the perfect stage for gladiatorial combat.
And it becomes the perfect stage for gladiatorial combat in part because there are no corners. And what you were referring to with Gladiator and Russell Crowe's character from that movie, which is that, you know, you have to learn how to entertain. You have to learn how to prolong. The reason for the oval shaped floor in the Colosseum was that so these gladiatorial battles could be prolonged for the fans.
That's right. And there was a whole other aspect of it as well. And that was that, there was, well, first of all, I mean, we're so familiar with the form because modern stadiums are exactly the same. You know, when we look at the Super Bowl, we're looking at a form that was created by the Romans and for these giant athletic events.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you have gone there because this feels like a rather good point in our podcast to begin making some comparisons. And I'm wondering if you believe that some of our modern sports and athletes are representative of not just Roman culture and Roman sports and games, but also of kind of the militaristic nature of our American society.
Well, you know, it is interesting. I mean, first of all, you know, we go back to the Greeks for the Olympics. Idealization of humans in form, the Greeks, you know, worshipped the human form and sculpted it and worked a lot of the human form even into their architecture. You should check out my film "Secrets of the Parthenon."
We'll have to do that. Yes.
Yes, please. And the Romans, of course, built on that. And interestingly, they took a lot of the Greek myths, and rather than just dramatize them and stage them theatrically, they went beyond that. They pushed it so that if there was in fact a death on stage with the Romans, they in fact actually killed people. And I think that, you know, clearly we don't do that in our modern football or our stadiums in the Super Bowl. But I think there is still something very similar in terms of you know, people coming together, watching these incredible, highly trained athletes competing on such a physical level. I mean, you know, I watch the Super Bowl and I see some of these wide receivers, you know, going long, catching the ball, you know, and knowing that they're going to get hit so hard, and then they just get up after that. I mean, I would just be dead, if they, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think there's a similarity there, and you know, thankfully the losers are not killed. I mean, look, I'm from Buffalo, so I've seen the Bills go to the Super Bowl, you know, how many? Four times in a row?
I think it was four times. Yes. Yeah, so in your case, you know how to, as a fan, deal with suffering.
Yes. Yes. I'm glad they were not killed at the end. Yes.
Well, it hasn't come to that, nor will it. But you know, one of the interesting things here with the, you know, American society and sports is that you see sports becoming more and more a place for fans and players to kind of promote their patriotism. And what I mean by that is that I can't remember another era in our history where so many teams have worn some sort of homage to the armed forces. You know, there are a lot of teams that have camouflage uniforms, and that there's, you know, entire things that are done to kind of recognize the efforts of our troops. And for good reason in some cases. But I'm wondering if that is an example of perhaps sports and athletes today representing this culture, this militaristic culture, and if there's a similarity to what was going on in ancient Rome.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, John. Interestingly, Catherine Welch, who wrote a book on basically the development of the amphitheater, before there was a Colosseum, there were gladiatorial events, and many of the public executions that took place in the Colosseum were previous to the building of the Colosseum in Rome. They were done in temporary structures. And those temporary structures were built of wood, and, you know, and they were stadium type structures, oval shaped, and they would build them in the Roman Forum. And the Roman Forum is sort of like the Washington Mall. So if you can imagine, you know, 100 days of, let's say, the Super Bowl being played, you know, on the Washington Mall, you know, somewhere between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial, and you know, everything stopping, you know, national holiday, come see these games and watch this event, and then it gives us a sense of certainly how important it was for the Romans. And I think you're right. I mean, I think the fact that we bring the military into it these days, I think that we try to elevate it to you know, an act of patriotism to, you know, actually watch the Super Bowl.
Interesting. Yeah, and I think you continue to reference the Super Bowl, and we are obviously both fans of the NFL, as the majority of Americans. It is the most popular sport in this country, but it certainly has faced its fair share of scrutiny recently, and justifiably so, because it hasn't always seemed like the NFL is all that much concerned with the long-term health and wellness of its players, both past and present. In this regard, how is this similar or different to the investment Roman owners made in their gladiators? Because you've heard of NFL players, at least you used to hear about NFL players more and more as kind of modern day gladiators. Do you think there's something to be said with how NFL players are treated post-career? There's something to be said with how Roman owners would treat their gladiators?
Well, again, interestingly, in our film, we have a forensic scientist.
Yes.
Fabian Kahns from Austria. He's a forensic scientist, and the Austrians had excavated a gladiator cemetery in Turkey, modern-day Turkey. It was part of the Roman Empire at that time. What he found was that there was quite a bit of evidence for healing. And his idea here was that the gladiators were receiving the best possible health care at that time. And in fact, we do know from Roman texts, particularly the Roman medical texts, that many of the great doctors of the Roman period trained as doctors to gladiators. And part of that was because many of the gladiators died, and the these early doctors were able to do autopsies on them and learn an incredible amount about their anatomy. But they were also able to, you know, sort of experiment with certain remedies to try to keep them alive. And the keeping them alive and keeping them healthy was, to a certain extent, a financial concern.
Right, yes.
Because if you figured out that, you know, if half of your, if at each gladiatorial bout, one person would die, I mean, that would be extremely expensive. The owners of gladiators had these schools that they would send them to, these training schools to actually teach them to, you know, be the best they possibly can be.
Because they were such a large investment to the owners, and the owners wanted a return on that investment.
Yes. So in that sense, it's you know, it's the same with the NFL. They want their players to be well taken care of. They want them to be in the, you know, best possible physical condition, and they want to get their money's worth out of them. You know, how they're treated after their you know, their careers are over, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a certain amount of deification and, you know, honoring of them through, you know, induction in the Hall of Fame or coming back out, you know, on the game, you know, for game days and saluting them. You know, the smartest players are the ones who, you know, understand that their career in professional sports is not going to last forever, and that they better have, you know, some plan for after they can't play anymore.
Yeah, you know, that entire scene where your medical examiner is looking at the bones of gladiators, it just, to me, it was an eerie similarity to what is going on in today's medical world, where you have doctors who are examining the brains of former NFL players to locate signs of brain damage, CTE, and things that happened during their playing careers that had otherwise, until this recent time, been undiagnosed. And I watched your documentary, and as a fan of the NFL, I couldn't help but make that connection.
Yeah. Well, there's a big difference, I think, between, you know, obviously gladiators, and a few big differences between gladiators and football players. And the obvious one is death, and very, very serious injury. The other is that, the gladiators were primarily slaves, and they didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. That's the majority of them. Some gladiators did come from the lower class, and they did volunteer to be gladiators because of the possibility of fame and fortune. They had families, and their winnings would go to their families, and their families could, in fact, profit from their risking their lives and being successful in the ring. Clearly with NFL players, they're doing it because they love the game. Nobody's forcing them to do it. But that said, I just think, personally, I would hope that we would do everything we possibly could to, prevent particularly brain injury.
Yeah, the history hasn't always shown that though, and it does seem like in perhaps a different era. To be fair to the NFL, that they have tried harder recently to protect the health and wellness of their players. But you know, I think more
disturbingly is young athletes, kids coming up in the little leagues and playing in high school and even in college. I have a daughter. I don't have a son, but I would think very carefully about letting my son play football.
Yeah, it's very true. These are the concerns that face us as parents. And you know, you bring up the long-term sustainability of the NFL, of football, which is, you know, very similar to the long-term sustainability of these gladiatorial games. Eventually, in the case of the Roman Colosseum, you're going to run out of stuff to kill, and you're going to have to look elsewhere. And with football, where you are starting to see the game experience some potential problems is that fewer and fewer young kids are playing the game because of these very health concerns that we've talked about. So if you want to focus on long-term sustainability of the NFL, you might want to look at the Pee Wee football leagues and how fewer and fewer kids are playing football because their parents have been following the stories about what damage can be done, and they don't want their kids to experience similar problems down the road.
Yeah. Well, I would hope that when you look at the technology that goes into covering the games, and certainly into the training of the players, that I would hope that we could make the same kind of technological commitment to the safety of the players as well.
A couple final questions here with filmmaker Gary Glassman. How hard do you think it would be for the organizers of the Super Bowl halftime show to have water come into the stadium, fill up the stadium, conduct some sort of scene, we're not talking naval battle, but some sort of scene on water, have that water then drain out by the end of halftime and resume play in, let's say, half an hour? Because of what I'm describing is a scene from the Colosseum, correct?
Yes. It's controversial. I have to say it's still controversial. I mean, and we were very careful to nuance our conclusion there. What our experts found was that he believed that the plumbing was there to make something like that possible. Whether they actually conducted them or not is the scholars. It's one of those hotly debated subjects. We do know that the Romans actually constructed special arenas for what they call pneumachiae, these mock sea battles, in which they would flood certain arenas and put people, prisoners again, on boats and have them battle each other and either kill each other by the sword or set their boats on fire and drown them. So we do know those activities did take place. The question is whether it actually took place in the Colosseum. And like I said, our expert Adriano Morabito of Subterranean Rome has found the potential plumbing system for making that happen. Now, could we do it today? I have no doubt we could do it today. Unfortunately, it didn't make it into the film. But for instance, there are a few shows in Las Vegas that are water arena shows. Le Rev at the Wynn Casino. They do a spectacular water show, and although they don't drain it with fast scene changes like that, they could, it's spectacular to see.
Well, if the NFL is listening, There is still plenty of time to recreate the same kind of magic in next year's Super Bowl.
Yes.
Well, Gary Glassman, I appreciate you taking the time to discuss your recent documentary, Colosseum Roman Death Trap, and I believe you have a couple others in the works these next few weeks, too.
Yes. February 18th is Petra, Lost City of Stone, February 25th, the following Wednesday, on Nova on PBS, is Hagia Sophia, Istanbul's Ancient Mystery. And with both of those, we do some incredible construction projects.
Well, we'll definitely be watching. Gary Glassman, thank you for taking the time on the View My Seats podcast.
Thank you, John.